Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Arik Devens. Arik has a delightfully weird resume, having written software at Netscape, Palm, Easel, Fitbit, and more. But for the past 5 years, he's been at Netflix, where he's been helping architect and build the iOS app that millions use to stream their favorite shows every day. Welcome, Arik.
Hi.
Hi.
We've never chatted before, so...
Yes, this is our first conversation. Arik and I have, for years, had a podcast called Fun Facts. And before and after we record that show about facts, we often find ourselves talking about engineering leadership and product development and a bunch of other stuff that doesn't belong in that show, but very much belongs in this show.
Yeah, I was excited that you started this show because I felt like you have so much to say on the topic, so many valuable insights to offer. And I've been enjoying it.
I'm trying to keep the focus on the guests. My insights, as useful as they may be, can take the little gaps in between the folks and all the various experiences you all have. So that's the fun part for me.
Right on. Sounds good.
So I'm really excited to dig in today. We'll see how far we get in one episode. want to talk about some of the challenges of leading and architecting an app with a massive user base. Netflix's culture, which is very unique, how it works in theory and practice, maybe. Yeah. But first, can we do a quick tour of your delightfully weird career path?
What do you think is delightfully weird about it? Let's start with that.
I mean, one of the things that I think really particularly sticks out to me, and maybe it particularly because you're not much older than me, but then like your first companies that you worked at were like these very like OG .com bubble. So you worked at like Easel, Netscape, and Palm, which is like, what a fascinating three companies to start your career off. Especially for somebody who's like in that like kind of like early 40s age range. Like, I don't know. How did that happen?
Well, let me start with this. I want to mention this because I feel like this is under normalized in the wider sort of engineering community. I do not have a CS degree.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. I went to a small liberal arts college in Ohio, and I started taking CS classes. I took like whatever the 100 level class is, you know, sort of intro to C. And by the second semester, I was teaching the class. And not because I'm like some super genius. I taught.
Because you're in a small liberal arts.
It's because it was a small liberal arts college and there was one professor and he didn't feel like doing it. So I taught a class on GTK Perl, which is like Perl in general, not, you know, kind of hilarious.
But GTK Perl.
There's actually kind of both Perl and GTK Perl. So that's like old, you know, GNOME, Linux development stuff. Anyway, quickly became clear that CS was not really going to be a thing. And then while I was there, they actually eliminated the major. So I ended up graduating with a degree in music. It was kind of the thing I had the most other credits in and something I've been passionate about my whole life. But I actually think there's quite a bit of overlap, at least in the music theory side, with sort of the kind of thinking that goes into engineering. At any rate, that particular school has a pretty cool program where you go to school year round, but it's sort of trimesters, and every other trimester you're expected to get some sort of internship. They call it a co-op somewhere in whatever field you're doing or something you're interested in or whatever. It can't be like maybe not working at a gas station, but you know, something interesting. And so my first one came and I sort of cold emailed this Linux company in Boston or Cambridge called Helix Code at the time. It was later called Zimian. People might know that later better, and was eventually acquired, I think, by Novell and something. And the same company ended up becoming Xamarin, which created Mono, which was acquired by Microsoft. And my boss from that company ended up being the CEO of GitHub for a while.
This is what I'm talking about. Like, anytime we start talking about career stuff, like, what's so fascinating? Like, anytime you start telling a story, and it's all interconnected. We're still in the preamble to your first job.
That's true. I guess you're right. So I guess I lived it. I don't think of it as anyway. So I did an internship there, and that internship led to an internship at a company called Easel out in Mountain View that was kind of an incredible, like, this is actually pretty amazing. It was definitely the most noteworthy group of talent I'll probably ever come across. It was a company started by famed original OG Mac software engineer Andy Hertzfeld, and he basically just pulled on all of his connections to get like all these people. So it was like Susan Kerr was there. Arlo Rose, who designed System 8, was there. Darren Adler, who's back at Apple now as some VP of something, but who is this, I believe, the tech lead for System 7, 8, 6, I'm not sure. This guy, John Sullivan, who was also an Apple tech lead for one of those classic OSs. A lot of early BOS people, a lot of early Sun people, all these like incredible people, including the entire original Safari team, who went
like Don
Pizzle.
Melton and
Don Melton was my boss.
Ken Kusienda, there.
And Maciej Stachowiak, who still runs the Safari team, I think. Don Melton, I call him Gramps, but yeah, Don, who by the way was like younger than I am now, probably at that time. But like, so he was there. So then, anyway, that company actually was pretty cool. They were building this file manager for Linux, and their business model was sort of like proto Dropbox, but it was just one of those things where.
But this is like in 1999.
Way
so
too
it was
early.
Like easy to raise money, but like fairly challenging to make a business out of like a Linux file manager with Dropbox.
Totally.
I mean, 2002 was the year of Linux on the desktop, so like they hadn't quite made it.
I got laid off, and Don had come from Netscape, and he got me an internship at Netscape. So that's how I ended up at Netscape. It was pretty cool too, because I was on this core team that built like the what they called Zool, which is like the XML UI layer. But the people on that team ended up creating the Camino browser, Firefox, and Safari. So it's, you know, just a couple of little browsers that people may have heard of.
It's just like a really interesting, those confluences of people. And there's a few other stories of this, of like a group of really talented, really smart people get pulled together for a handful of time. And then like,
and
don't necessarily succeed. But like, yeah, and Arik. But like the story, I don't know, I find them fascinating. It's like the rock super group sort of stories. Where like,
and they all do their own albums.
Yeah, yeah.
Like these people used to be together at this browser that you all use. I actually like left the tech industry then for a few years, was like bartending and doing whatever, and ended up getting an interview at Palm through that classic method of a family friend who worked there, who got me the interview. I mean, you know, I think most people's success, if they think about it, sort of is some percentage of ratio of like luck, hard work, and privilege.
Yes.
Right. And so in my case, I was very privileged to have a family friend who worked at Palm who said, I can't get you a job, but I can get you an interview, which at that point, you know, having only had internships was huge. And so that was my first real job. And I happened to work there from 06 to 08. So I was definitely there when the iPhone was announced and released, working on a competitor product that eventually became WebOS and the Palm Pre. So
yeah, you were in there, you were up in there when there was the drama of like, because Palm had been, actually I was working on Palm OS stuff.
Yeah, you worked there later, right?
I worked on like Palm apps in like, I guess, 06 era, like when it was like pre-iPhone announced. And then I worked at Palm for a little while on some WebOS stuff after the fact. Were you there when there was kind of like the, oh God, we really need to bet the company on something that is not just this old stack evolved of the coming from the black and white Palm days?
Totally. It was super interesting. So when I was hired, their plan, they had a plan to make something new. They knew Palm OS 5 was like, you know, like way past its expiration date, but they had that classic problem of like, it's really hard to disrupt yourself.
Yes.
Right. So they were still selling all these Trios and Centros. Was that the little one?
Yeah.
And all this stuff. And so they hired me into this team that was working on new media apps for a device they were going to build. So they had signed a deal with Texas Instruments for this like DSP chip. And they were going to build a new Linux-based kernel phone using this DSP. And a very smart person at Palm had managed to make a Palm 5 Linux emulator.
Okay.
So all of the UI for this was going to be through this Palm 5 layer that was like talking through these like memory pipes to like, and memory map pages and things to this like Linux kernel.
Okay.
So I was hired. Yeah, it was a crazy idea. So I was hired to do the UI part of like, I was hired to, well, kind of UI and other stuff for like these media apps. So I was working on an image viewer, but like, you know, this is Palm 5. So they gave me like a off-the-shelf book about Palm development from like 10 years earlier.
And a C compiler.
Yeah, and we're like, hey, you go for it. And I'm like trying to write a JPEG library, you know, so, and like write my own widgets. But so we're working on that and we had gotten, I don't know, 70 or 80% done. It's hard to say. And then the iPhone was announced and very, very quickly, they were like, okay, well, this was because the idea was that this would be like their kind of like last Palm 5 phone before the big new thing happens. But of course, you know, they'd said that many times. So they very quickly pivoted and they acquired this company whose name I have long since forgot, but it was a competitor to Android.
Okay.
So at the time in the Valley, there were like a bunch of startups doing sort of things like Android sort of. And so they bought this company. They had this Java based system with like this sort of CSS-ish UI layer thing.
Sounds performant.
Yeah. Well, we started working on that. And first of all, I hadn't done any Java. So now I'm like learning Java at work, trying to like write these apps. So I started working on a new media app, same thing, the image viewer or something like that for this new system. And it quickly became apparent that, yeah, this was just never going to work. Like the system was super slow. You know, all this Java stuff was a nightmare at the time. And
now you have a new bar where before you're comparing yourself to like other Palm devices. And now like everyone knows what the iPhone can do and that it's going to eat your lunch unless you're really shipping something totally different in 6 to 18 months.
So I ended up working on this. It's actually, you're so right about the connections. I ended up working on the email app for this device with this guy named Mark Blank who wrote Zork.
Okay.
And like started info games.
Like the OG games, yeah.
Yeah, and like created Siphon Filter if you ever played like that one for PS2, PS1. Anyway, so he's this like games developer who'd been like a Palm enthusiast. And this other guy named Matt Kern who's like a old school Ruby on Rails developer. And that guy and a bunch of other like superstars from the team, they all got together and they came up with this WebOS idea of using WebKit and web technologies to like basically do like Ruby on Rails OS.
Right.
And so that kind of happened and everything pivoted that way. But there, I do have a couple of fun anecdotes about that. One was that we hired a bunch of kernel engineers from Apple and like OS engineers like right after the iPhone shipped. Right, they were just like looking for something new to do. And I was talking to one of them. I'm like, why did you leave Apple? Why'd you come here? And he's like, oh, man, I just need some life, work-life balance.
Mm.
This is just a much more pleasant place to be. Not so stressful.
Your life and death battle is like chill compared to what was happening at Apple.
And I'm just saying like, I don't believe in like hashtag, you know, 90 hours a week and loving it. But like, Palm did completely fail. Apple did succeed. But the other thing that was super interesting being there sort of behind the scenes was that, you know, you mentioned that the iPhone came out and it was like set a whole new standard for what expected. And one of those big things which Steve Jobs discussed at length in the original presentation was this multi-touch technology.
Yes.
Right. And how they had, and we've patented it, right? We've got this lock under lock and key, and the crowd goes wild because Apple historically has had trouble with that, the famous look and feel lawsuit.
Yes.
But so then, you know, Android had, like Google had released this like prototype Android phone that looked like a Palm Windows phone trash thing. But when they came out with Android, people don't really remember this. The original Android didn't have multi-touch.
Yeah, I remember that. It had a little, it even supported like a little like toggle, like you could go, you navigate it with like up, down, left, right.
Yeah. But when the Palm Pre came out, it fully supported multi-touch.
Yes.
Why? Why was that okay? And the answer, according to people inside Palm at the time, is that Palm had a bunch of patents for the basically everything about a smartphone because of the Trio and stuff. They were so early.
Yeah.
But more importantly, way more importantly, Palm had the patent for the click wheel on the iPod. And Palm basically said to Apple, like, don't come at us, we won't come at you.
Right.
So it was a mutually assured destruction thing. So they were allowed to like use all this stuff that Apple felt was theirs because they owned a lot of stuff.
Man, and Steve Jobs must have hated that so much.
He must have just steamed under it, right?
But also that's so much of big company patent stuff is like everyone just needs to get more and more dumb patents so that we have more dumb patents and you have more dumb patents. And
perpetuates itself.
And so tiny companies get crushed and all the big companies just have all of their lasers pointed at each other, but then mostly are peaceful.
I mean, I think ultimately Palm became a patent sale at some point.
Yes, it did.
Yeah. Long after my time.
So I'll link to, I believe years back, you did a debug episode with Rene Ritchie.
Yeah, I did.
Where you talked about a lot of these like fun, in more detail, exploits and adventures. But you worked through Easel, Netscape, Palm, and freelancing and all these generational things. And if you want to insert anything else in that path that we can do. But then you ended up doing some time at Fitbit. When the Apple Watch was announced. And you had another generation of like, oh, bam.
Yeah, it's like bad luck for me to be there, right? Like,
yeah, but at Fitbit, as I understand it, you were getting into this type of role where you're on iOS development team, but you're taking this kind of architectural view on, okay, we have all these developers and they're all writing code and you're helping kind of like coordinate that. And also you're working on an app that's like at a pretty decent scale. Like, I don't know what the numbers were on the Fitbit app, but you know, a fair number of people are using that app for a fair amount of data exchange. So
yeah, it was at that time. I mean, I thought that was crazy scale. I mean, I forget what it was now. Maybe we'll say 15 million, something like that.
15 million. Mind blown.
15.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah.
But then now like Netflix has more than 15 million.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So when I was hired at Fitbit, there were like 150, 200 people, something like that. It was
at the whole company or
in the whole
software.
Company. Yeah. In the whole company. And I thought, oh, this is huge.
Yeah.
Because I'd been working at like a 15 person startup. I mean, you know, for context, when I worked at Netscape, there were like, I don't know, 50,000 people or whatever.
Probably, yeah.
Palm was, I don't know how many thousands, but this felt big to me. But so I was on an iOS team originally of like 5 people. And I ended up owning this architecture, data, network, sort of infrastructure stuff, kind of largely semi-accidentally. Up until that point, I had thought of myself as kind of a UI guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mainly in building some features, I sort of stumbled into the architecture they had and really didn't like it and was pushed by my then boss to be like, okay, well, they just fired the guy who had done that work. So they're like, well, you don't like it. Go do something better, right? Kind of vibe. And I, you know, hopefully I did. But I think what was really interesting about the technical challenge at Fitbit that I think people don't necessarily appreciate beyond the scale and because of the scale is that Fitbit was a app that had to work fully offline.
Right.
Because if you're out in the woods on a camping trip and you want to log your food and you can't because it says, you don't have a network signal, then you're just like, well, I'm never going to use this app again, right? Like, this is supposed to be this quantified self concept of like, I'm always tracking the data so I can do something useful with it later, I guess. But like, if you can't do that, then you're like, I'm out. So we suddenly created a distributed systems problem. Because like usually, most iPhone apps are sort of dumb readers, right? They're like,
yes,
the source of truth is clearly on the server. They just show it. There may be some complicated caching. There may be some optimizations they want to do for network latency and those kind of things. But at the end of the day, if you run into trouble, just drop it all. Just pull it again.
Pro tip for anyone out in the audience there, avoid making a distributed systems problem in your product. if you can make your app be primarily about reading and displaying from the API, then you're going to have a much easier and calmer life than if you end up creating a synchronization of large volume of data in both directions.
Yeah, so you're doing conflict resolution and transaction resolution and all this stuff on an iPhone. Not to mention, that particular company had chosen to use Core Data.
Right.
Actually, I think primarily the reason I caught the job in the first place was that when asked about Core Data in my tech screen, I went on like apparently like a 25-minute unprompted rant about how bad it was.
And so they're like, of course I ended up owning it. This person has seen the pain that we've seen. So.
Yeah, let's put him in charge of this.
Yeah.
So you're writing these like rolling migration systems and stuff. But yeah, it was, so the company grew really fast. Like I was there for 3.5 years, I think, and it went from 200 people to like 2,000 people.
Right.
So 10x in 3+ years is pretty fast. That's that hyper growth. And the iOS team in specific went from like 5 people to maybe 45 people.
Right. So 10x as well.
Yeah, exactly. Matt, that's a good point, matching the overall growth. And so suddenly, you know, I went from being the person writing all the foundational technology to the person managing tech leading, I guess. I was kind of a people manager for a while, but primarily my job was tech leading and principal architecting the team that owned all of those technologies, and also trying to, you know, engage with all of the other teams. Because when we started out, we had a very flat, like most small companies will have, is a very flat platform team. Like everything is sort of device oriented or platform oriented. So you have an iOS team and you have an Android team and maybe you have a web team and whatever else. And then eventually we switched to what I think most companies eventually end up at, is this like hybrid model where you have these vertical feature teams and these horizontal platform teams.
Right.
And so we had all these feature teams that were very PM aligned. So it's like, okay, we have a PM for sleep, so there's going to be a sleep team. We have a PM for food, so we're going to have a food team. We have a PM for activity tracking, so we're going to have an activity tracking team. And those teams were mixtures of iOS, Android, web, API, you know, all these different disciplines. But then we still had to have these horizontal platform teams one for iOS, one for Android. I forget what other ones we had, but like to build those core technologies that are not sort of feature related and own all of the stuff.
Yeah, and to set conventions and expectations about
that's right.
that individual features are going to work together properly at the networking boundaries and data storage and
yeah,
all that.
Yeah, because
kind of
otherwise
stuff.
You end up with all
the
these
build
like,
needs
conflicting.
To work.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't want to end up like there was that Facebook post recently that
oh god. we can link it.
We could go off on an hour long discussion of that, but I think I would say in the spirit of Alan's don't make distributed systems apps if you can avoid it. Don't build an app that has like six different UI frameworks in it.
Yeah.
If you can avoid it. Like it's just a bad
idea. Try not to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. When Facebook is in the extreme case, I've long assumed that they're the largest iOS team that is out there, but I don't know for sure that that's true. Certainly one of the largest.
They're very, very large. Big.
And they have gone through, and I'd be interested to dig into this with you a bit, about the way that you scale and organize development teams as in the way that you describe, where it's like at a certain scale, you end up typically almost always teams to end up breaking up. And so there's the feature teams and then there's the platform team that supports all the feature teams and tries to manage some sort of consistency across them. But then once you've made that change, then there's less friction to adding more feature teams as you get more and more and more and more feature teams. And then you end up at like Facebook's scale where it was even actually many years ago. I remember meeting someone at a conference and they're like, oh, I work at Facebook. I'm like, okay, cool. That's great. What team do you work on? And they're like, oh, we work on the spell checking yeah. in the text field
in
that
the
you're
text.
In the wall. Like when you're on the wall, it's the spell checker for the wall.
Yeah.
But just for that part of that text editor.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's a team. That's a whole team that does that.
That's not even one person's job. That's multiple people's
full-time
job.
That was the team they're on. And so it had a PM and it had designers and blah, blah, blah. and that kind of like my head reeled a little bit, having like mostly worked on non-Facebook scale. Because there's the scale of the team and then the scale of the user base. And those, they're correlated, but definitely don't need to be in lockstep, right? When you have twice as many users, you don't need twice as many developers. I guess before digging into in the broader sense, is Netflix organized that way that or at least the Netflix iOS app, is organized that way by now in this feature teams and then there's a platform team?
Yes, but full transparency disclosure, it was reorganized that way right before I went on paternity leave. So I haven't actually experienced what it's going to look like at Netflix. So for most of my time there, it's been organized as a horizontal platform teams. They just did this.
Yeah, so I bet there'll be people in the audience that are fairly surprised that the Netflix iOS app that has, or I don't know if you can say how many millions, I know Netflix has like a quarter of a billion subscribers.
It's a lot. It's a very
big
number.
A lot of those probably use the app, right? So it's like probably closer to 100 million user app that you were able to get that far, that only now is the team getting organized into this arrangement of having the feature teams and then platform team. What is the, again, to the degree you're able to say, what is the size of that iOS team that was operating at least fairly successfully kind of without that organization until recently?
Yeah, I actually have no idea if that's public information or not. So I won't be specific, but I will say it was orders, at least an order of magnitude smaller than Facebook's, right? Like, I mean, you know, it was actually a surprisingly small team.
So I guess maybe the like most interesting question for me is like, was it under 150 or over 150?
Under.
It was under yeah.
Way
so,
under.
Way. Okay. That's what I was pretty sure that was true. A lot of organizational things break at 150 and like kind of famously you kind of have to redesign any organization or team that exceeds that size. But when you're in the like the kind of low tens of people is when most organizations do tend to make that transition from the like a lot of 20%, 30% teams are not set up that way, but most like 80% teams I think are set up in the way that they have feature teams and the platform team. And so it sounds like you maybe Netflix maybe is making that transition around a similar, the Netflix iOS team, I should say, is making that tradition around the same size that a lot of organizations do. But it sounds like clearly that Netflix's iOS team, and I think this transfers across the culture more broadly, did more with fewer people than a lot of apps of that scale or really even of any scale. To what degree is that like, was an explicit like mandate / philosophy? And how does that kind of like tie into Netflix's like unique kind of cultural priorities and things? Like, was that an enabler of that? Or I don't know. Tell me about that.
Every company I've ever joined has probably at some point used that C word, right? Used culture as a word. Said, the culture here. It's, yeah. And to my experience pre-Netflix, that was always kind of a little...
A poster on the wall.
Yeah, it was just like, these all kind of seem the same, and there's flavors, and there's little differences here and there, and whatever, and they're different sizes and things like that. But it didn't really mean anything. Netflix is... really does operate pretty fundamentally differently than any other company I've been in. And I think there are other ones like that. I know sort of Apple, maybe a little bit, Amazon. There are companies that have very strong opinionated workplaces, and you either fit that, that works for you, or it doesn't. Mm-hmm. So I would say that, you know, for me, Netflix is a phenomenal place to work. It's definitely not for everyone. I think there are other people who are great, talented people who just wouldn't like it, and it wouldn't bring out the best in them. One of the things that historically was true, not true anymore, about Netflix was that we only hired, I don't know when you're supposed to say they and we, but we only hired people who were already at what you would consider a senior software engineer.
Yeah, and like famously, the only title for an engineer at Netflix was senior software engineer. And so you have people who'd be like principal staff ultra principal developer somewhere else. It's just like senior software engineer. It's like, we're not going to ding around and have titles.
One of the main reasons for titles at other companies is for pay banding. And Netflix does what they call top of personal market for compensation. So they try to pay people the most that they could reasonably be expected to earn at any other job.
Yeah, and the philosophy, as I understand it, is that Netflix wants people to never consider changing jobs because of more pay. They want Netflix to be in charge of whether or not you want to leave.
That's exactly right. Yeah, yeah. They want to take that out of the equation.
Yeah, yeah.
At any rate, to more directly to your question, I think that because of that, because we only hired senior engineers, and because the standards for that hiring were very high, and we really only hired out of need, we never fell into that just hire anyone good you can find thing. Mm-hmm. We'll just have more people. We'll find something for them to do. We never did that. We were very deliberate on hiring. It was like, there's an area we feel like we're missing in. There's something we have, we need someone to do. Let's go find someone who would fit that role well. We were hiring generalists, but like, in some sense, but it was also more like, what do you bring to the table that no one else on the team has?
Right, culture adds.
How do you level up the team? Yeah, exactly. So because of that, you know, people took on a lot, and there was also just a lot of trust, still is, a lot of trust and agency. I would say the core concept of Netflix culture is basically to hire smart people, give them as much context as you can, and then let them run with it. And trust that you made, that approval came in the hiring. Like we found someone we believe in, let's let them run. And if they go off in the wrong direction, you know, you course correct. If they continue to go off in the wrong direction, then you part ways, right? So rather than make everything a process along the way, remove as much process as possible and deal with bad outcomes as unavoidable individual situations, as opposed to trying to protect yourself constantly from outlier bad outcomes. You know, the famous example would be like one person in the US tried to smuggle something into an airport in their shoe, got caught, and now everyone has to remove their shoes forever.
Right. And that accumulates in large companies and eventually tends to choke large companies. I haven't read the book yet, the No Rules Rules, which I think I assume by the title is about the avoidance of rules, among other things, at Netflix culture.
I actually haven't read it either. Sorry, Reed. But yeah, it's I lived it. I don't need to
read
it.
You lived it, you know. But the kind of a concept, as I understand it, and I've seen it happen, is that the rules tend to get added more often than they get removed. And so you constrain the ability for people to act rapidly and use their judgment, which reduces the error rate and the problem rate. But then it also kind of more problematically doesn't pay for itself in terms of how much it slows down product progress ability for you to all execute.
There's like this classic article or something or whatever that the original HR director, whose name I think was Patty McCord, if I remember correctly, she's kind of the one who is credited with sort of popularizing this sort of overall culture at Netflix. And one of the things she said was that, you know, in a traditional company, as it grows in size, like you said, you know, there's like these inflection points. And as it grows in size, employee freedom tends to decrease.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think that most people feel like that's inevitable. And to some extent, I'm sure it is. But the idea behind Netflix for a long, long time, at least, was what if as you scale, you increase employee freedom instead of removing it, instead of decreasing it? So there was just like no mandate of corporate spyware on your computer, no mandate of PR requests for code check-ins, no mandate, like just not a lot of process, just really, really light on process. And instead what you do is enable adults to be to do their best work and treat them like adults.
Yeah, but the treat them like adults is that if you don't have a rule across the entire company that you have to have PR requests, but then somebody's going around cowboying, checking in things without PR reviews,
yeah, that's going to be a problem.
Problems, that's that person's fault. It's not like, well, you know, that's our fault for not having a rule around it. It's like, hey, you're breaking stuff and you're supposed to be a grown-up and we're paying you top of personal market.
That's right. Yeah, don't, if you break the build every week, there's going to be a problem.
Yeah, and that problem may involve someone else having your role that listens to common sense when they're going around making big changes.
That's exactly right. So for a very, very long time, we got away with having one team that was just sort of all together on a platform. I mean, we technically had two teams because there was like another team that dealt with like streaming tech and, you know, authentication and things like that, really low level. But for above that level, everything was kind of one team for my whole time there so far.
And that when that it was a lot of that, if not all of it, was attributable to being able to keep the team size low by having the average person on the team very senior, by having a minimal amount of rules and restrictions on process that people have to follow. Obviously, people opt into process. They follow processes that make sense given their context. And then also being constrained, I assume, on scope. Like the Netflix app is relatively featureful in the scheme of things, but it's not a kitchen sink with 10,000 gidgets and gizmos everywhere.
No, I would say Fitbit had more features.
Yeah.
I mean, Fitbit was a surprisingly large app. Like, people don't really think about it because most people only used some percentage of the surface area, but it's like food tracking alone was a huge, like there are whole food apps, right? And Fitbit had that whole thing built in, and the sleep tracking is a whole app for most places, and that was built in, and workouts are a whole app, and that was built in. So there were just huge areas of that app. I mean, you could understand. I mean, I still think the Facebook example of someone doing a spell checker of a one field is insane, but
not just someone doing it, a whole team doing
it. Well, and that's the thing. I think at most big companies, what you find, and we just saw this with, you know, did Twitter cut too many people? Yes. But was Twitter way too big? Also, yes. And I think that what you end up is that in most big companies that I've been at, everyone basically knows who are the people who are actually doing anything. And those people tend to just talk to each other. They tend to bypass everybody else and they'll just go directly from person to person and be like, okay, I'm a person getting something done over here and I need something from this other team. I know the person I can talk to on that team where something will actually happen. Because if I go to the front door, Lord knows what's going to happen. It's going to be 6 months later, backlog story pointed to death, because most of the people there are just there doing a job. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that. I mean, you can get a lot done with a lot of people if you want. I think there's just some people who feel constrained by that and want to be in a situation where they don't have to protect themselves as much from that, where it's not about politics and where it's just about people wanting to help each other get things done.
There's definitely trade-offs, right? So the organizational structure where it's like, okay, everybody can just work on whatever they feel is the highest impact thing, more or less. But then like if you misunderstand what the highest impact thing is and or you misunderstand how to get it done, then it seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, that Netflix is tending to push down strategic thinking in the org to lower levels, down to maybe even the individual contributor level, where because you have more freedom of how you spend your time and attention and what you're working on, how you do it, and it's less like your manager's manager has helped groom a backlog and then you're supposed to do those things in that exact order, then that means that you have more latitude to be working on the wrong thing and then you can be responsible for that failure, as opposed to it being like, well, that's our fault for not feeding you like a well-groomed backlog.
Yeah, I would say, you know, the phrase that comes up a lot is highly aligned, loosely coupled.
Okay.
And I think that is exactly what it says on the tin. It puts a different like job requirement on an engineering manager, because an engineering manager at Netflix is less about control and more about context. So it's their job to have more context than you and to be able to say, so when you come to them in your one-on-one and say, hey, I've identified a need here and I'm going to get together with this team to do it. Or I talk to a product manager and he wants to do this feature, or I think we need this infrastructure piece built. You know, they're going to talk to you and say, okay, well, have you talked to this person over here? Because I heard them say something that I think sounds similar. You should probably get aligned. Or do you know about this company-wide initiative? Or have you heard about this priority? Or like, how does that further this? You know, they're not going to tell you you can't do it. At the end of the day, they're not going to. That's not their job. But they are going to try to get you to think about it and make sure that you've done the due diligence, you know, and that's kind of their job to say like, hey, I know more than you do about what's going on outside of your limited sphere. I trust you in that sphere, but like, let me point you in some directions and let me try to like, you know, keep you within those bounds that you're talking about so that you don't go off. So it should be hopefully very rare that someone goes off and just completely goes on some adventure
crusade.
Hunt. Yeah. Yeah. And like, just, we all look up and go, what has this person been doing for 5 months? You know, I'm not saying it's impossible, but it is, it should not be very common. And I think that the other thing too, is that you if you're going to organize this way, you have to over-index in your hiring and retention for people who are extremely collaborative minded and people who, even if they're cowboy coders, collaborative in a organizational sense.
What does that mean to you? Like, what would be the idea of a cowboy? I think of a cowboy coder as a non-collaborative, a person who's going off and on their own journey and just...
No, because you can do both. It's often true that there's only one person working on something.
Hmm. Especially when you have a disciplinedly small team.
Right. But that person needs to be communicating with the rest of the team and collaborating with the rest of the team in terms of those touch point surfaces and what, you know, especially because, you know, famously at all of these big companies, it's all A/B testing, right? So
yeah,
you have this app that represents some, like everyone's app is some bespoke collection of features that are on or off or whatever. So if you're existing in an environment where you have shared canvases and a lot of tests happening, you have to be able to collaborate so that you don't break other people's tests, so that you exclude the right tests, so that you combine those learnings, so that you incorporate them, so that you land in the right order and things like that. So there's a lot of like sort of collaboration at the organizational level is what I mean, even if you're not collaborating on a code level.
Right.
You're collaborating on a code level in the sense that you're probably editing some of the same files, but you know what I mean? Like you're not working on a team. It's not like you and another person are designing and building something together. You're doing it, but you have to do that in an environment with other people who are also doing that.
Yeah, and that structure where individual engineers are taking the majority of a given feature rather than being like, okay, five people are all coming together and building this thing, has a whole bunch of prerequisites in terms of like how complicated and how maintainable and how architecturally thoughtful is the code you're
well,
all working in.
As it turns out, you can get away with it being awful as long as the people are really good.
Okay. Yeah.
Again, you can cover over most things with talented enough and motivated enough and senior enough people who just know, who don't need a lot of handholding and know what they're doing. Those same people would presumably move even faster in a world where that wasn't true. But in fact, you can get by for a very long time. I will say that the other piece of that collaboration piece is that, and the sort of the overall idea of the coupling is that, you know, you have to over-index on people who are collaborative. You also have to over-index on people who take feedback well and give feedback well.
Yeah. So you and I've talked about that a bunch, and I feel like there's about 20 follow-up things from everything you've said over the last 5 minutes that I could ask. I'd like to talk more about the feedback piece, maybe have you back at some time, but on looking at the time, I even more importantly want to give a chance to touch on something that is kind of follows from what we were talking about before, which is this topic of helping drive architectural and platform level positive change in a code base that has been around a long time and has a relatively large number of people on it and has a really large user base. And that's, as I understand, like you've focused in on that, you know, since this experience of Fitbit, you focused in that in your career. There's these different, you know, as an individual contributor, there's these different career paths where some people become like the problem solver that goes in and like fixes a gnarly issue in this part of the code base. And then later they fix this gnarly issue. And some people become like the execution expert that like, you know, builds the main features in this particular area. But you've taken this like architectural path where you're helping, not exclusively as I understand it, but like you're helping coordinate and scale things that has a wide impact across the whole sort of platform, product, company, or whatever. I'd be curious to hear you share a little bit of like, what have you learned in being a fair number of years into doing that kind of work? And what are your approaches for if you have some feature, you know, maybe pulling from your Fitbit experience or Netflix experience or how those contrast? It's like, what have you learned in effectively driving change across a large code base when you're trying to level things up in terms of engineering? And how does your approach nowadays contrast to maybe when you were a little greener or maybe a little more naive about like, all right, everybody, we're all going to be good now. And then like maybe that not everyone follows along, you know?
In some sense, the easiest way to do it is to be really early on an app.
Okay.
If the app is not that old, or if it's being redone for some reason, you know, like iOS 7 has just happened, you know, that kind of thing. Or it's a really small team where people want someone to take care of that.
Yeah.
that's like the easiest way to do it, right? Because if there isn't anything, or there is something and it's bad, and you just kind of step in and say, I'm going to manage that, you know, handle this. The best is actually if the app is being started from scratch, right?
Sure.
You just do it. But if you're in this environment that it's already a well-established app, you've got people who have been in there a long time, and especially if you're in an environment where there hasn't been any sort of cohesion and you have a lot of different approaches in different places, it's really hard. It ends up coming down to a lot of the times, like having earned respect through personal relationships, you know, having had a track record of good changes, but also just being, ultimately, you have to be quite a strong advocate, like, for those changes. You really have to become a little bit of an internal developer evangelist, right? Because you're basically coming to people and saying, okay, there's going to be some cost, right? These people are they have completely different motivations and goals than you do. Right? Especially if you're working in an environment where you've got a lot of sort of feature developers.
Yeah.
Right. And you're coming in and you're saying, okay, I want to change out the ground underneath you. Now, there are different levels to this. So if the change is something so far below their ground that they don't know it's there or care, great. just do it. So if you're replacing like one image caching solution with another, you know, or you're changing out how the internals of the network API work, as long as the surface area they touch can remain the same or very similar, they don't care.
Yeah, but I think the interesting, tricky, gnarly things that people either get impaled on or are heroes for is when you can bring across a change that isn't encapsulated well, that it's like, okay, now I need you all to stop using this pattern that is making the app slower and slower and slower, and do this like a bit less convoluted or a bit less convenient thing that maybe you're not familiar with.
Yeah, and you might fail. And I think it comes down a lot to timing and quality and like what the value is. I mean, at some companies, you just have the authority, right? That's another option. If you're at a company where they've said, this person is the principal and they're in charge of this and they do what they want and you're just all going to have to do it. And then they all just have to do it.
Well, that's how you get into the sort of architecture astronaut problem, though, where like somebody's been promoted so highly that they no longer need to worry about the mere mortals who are actually implementing any of this stuff. And so then architectural mandates come down that everyone resents, even if they're good.
Even if they're good, because they're so disconnected. But if you're not in that situation and if you're in a collaborative environment where you don't have any authority over people, what you have over them is more focus on the area than they do, right? They're not paying as much attention to the thing you're paying attention to. So if if they value you as a coworker and they know you're focused on that area and they believe in you, you can try to do it. But as an example, I tried to move an app to a unidirectional data flow
right
pattern from like a bidirectional.
All the rage now
from a bidirectional data flow. And I did it in a sort of Redux-y kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't pure Redux. It wasn't even pure ReSwift, but it was something along those lines. And it failed. Like no one used it because I was ahead of the point of time where anyone was thinking about that. Not because I'm so brilliant. I just was like, I had been hanging out with, web developers, but no one on the iOS side was thinking about that.
And also like changing that way of thinking, like it's not like a convenient, if you're like, oh, here's a simpler way that you can get things done with less code. And then you can like remove a bunch of stuff and it just kind of boop.
No, this is a fundamental brain shift, right? This is like, and I think it wasn't until Swift UI came out. And then all of a sudden people started saying, oh, that's a good idea. And you're like, yeah, I know.
now you can, if we make this thing more like that, then it'll be more like Swift UI. And
it'll work better with Swift UI. Yeah. Everything will be smoother and
great,
cleaner.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Exactly. And I think, and in that particular case, the case I'm talking about where I failed, what I ended up doing was taking out essentially all of the architecture and just using the pattern in like one part of the app.
Hmm.
And just did like, just encapsulated things in that way, but with no formalness to it. And so I got it in and people used it, but it never took over like the whole thing, right? It didn't happen.
Yeah, it's not surprising, unfortunately. Like a really common pattern I'm seeing all the way back to when I was a developer at Apple and all the way through various projects I've worked on is that there's so much gravity towards people And this is especially true when you have a mixed seniority team, a little bit less true when you have all senior developers, but still happens a lot, is like people have a gravity towards following the conventions and the code that's already local to where they're working.
Yep.
And so if it's like, okay, everybody, even if everybody totally is paying attention during your presentation pitch, all new networking should use this API.
Right? They don't do it.
Then they're looking at a section of code and they're adding something and then they see that it makes a networking call using the old library, and it's not like it's going to stop working tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's, you know, you either have to go in and do it all yourself, literally remove the old thing.
And have a PR that is so large that it's constantly unmergeable and constantly breaking.
Like everyone stop working all day. I'm going to get this thing
for the next 6 weeks while I go and refactor everything.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Like, yeah, it's a real challenge. I mean, you're trying to change the engine of a car as it's driving down the highway, and it's like the speed bus. If you drop below a certain amount of speed, it explodes.
Yeah.
So like it's quite a, but that's what I enjoy about it. Right. It's like, it's not just like, you know, there are so many interesting challenges that come with building an architecture at scale anyway. And then, as you mentioned, you were talking about scale of users, but also scale of development teams and scale of sort of complexity space, right? Problem complexity. Like, what is the company trying to achieve and how complicated is that? Because if you're building an app that does something that's very simple, then, you know, your complexity space in the architecture should also be fairly simple, right? But if you're building out something with complexity to it, inherent complexity to it, and if you have all three of those things, sort of complexity of problem, scale of development team, and scale of user base, it gets really fun. It's really challenging. I don't think it's for everyone, but I look at these like UI engineers who are just like sweating over really tiny details of like what an ease in, ease out curve looks like, or like one pixel to the left, one pixel to the right. And I'm blessed that I can see all those things, which is cool. Not everyone can. Yeah, or cursed. But I can see it. But I don't have the passion anymore to try to fix it.
Hmm.
Instead, I find that same sort of passion in like trying to figure out, okay, like we're talking about, how do I build this infrastructure architecture in a way that will be useful enough to these people that they'll use it? Or how do I set a line somewhere where I can make these changes I need to make underneath them, where they're not going to care, right? Like that kind of stuff.
So one of the things I mentioned before, I want to loop back to before we run out of time here, is, and then have to have you back again, because like I have all these notes of things I wanted to ask you about and like little pieces of conversations we have, but I feel like I'm just like, I'm speed running the conversation, is about this challenges when you have a large code base. So a lot of folks who are listening probably have worked either in a product or a design or engineering level on code bases and products that have had hundreds of thousands of users or maybe millions of users. But once you get into the tens and hundreds of millions of users, there's certain things that, challenges that come up. And so I'd be curious if you have any like stories you could share or maybe patterns that you've seen that make that kind of work interesting.
Again, what creates the most complexity is all this testing.
Mm-hmm.
By which I mean A/B testing. And also like, you know, when a transition like Swift happens, right? So most people who work on these kind of apps, you have this really old code base that's probably largely in Objective-C, and then Swift shows up and it's like all the new stuff is being done in Swift, and then you're like dealing with all that complexity. But then on top of that, you really have these A/B tests where like it's really hard to reason about like what code is even being executed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, what of this are we using? Because like, what tests am I in? You know, like, and are we testing the code that is on the off path? And like, are we missing, you know, it's more of a quality control issue, but it does make sort of working in that environment pretty complicated. I'm not sure if I'm completely talking about the thing you were talking about, though.
You're not, well, I mean, it's certainly correlated, right? Like the more users you have, the more useful your A/B tests are. And a lot of people who are working on products that are like earlier in their growth curve will start try to implement a whole bunch of A/B testing on something that has like tens of thousands of users, and then they just get noise as data.
There's no signal.
Right. But when you have millions of users and tens and hundreds of millions of users, then A/B tests, A, can get way more signal. And B, if you can tweak some outcome by a relatively small amount,
you could have a massive, massive wins. It's amazing how these tiny, tiny wins are magnified over that scale.
And then they compound across each other. And so it sounds like one of the tendencies, one of the side effects of that is that you accumulate a lot of A-B tests. The question that comes to mind is, do you have tools or maybe just discipline for baking in and then removing the code around all the A-B tests that end up just getting kind of permanently turned on?
You should.
Okay.
It's probably pretty helpful.
You imagine that would be helpful.
I could imagine that would be pretty helpful. Yeah, it's really complicated. The complexity kind of grows in every direction. So even something that's maybe surprisingly complex is just figuring out, okay, what even is the list of tests that someone's in?
That seems like that would be like one of the straightforward things. But...
No, it's not at all, because there are a lot of factors. So first of all, there's a lot of exclusion issues. So if one test is saying, I want people on this platform who've only been a member or user for this long.
In this cohort,
who've only been on this device, who have these capabilities. And then you're saying, okay, and my code doesn't work at this. So then you're like, okay, well, I'm testing the same area, but I want completely different things. And I can't have a user in both, because then they've violated it won't be useful signal. So you're saying, okay, well, if your test is on, my test can't be on. Or like even just, yeah, resolving like, okay, I'm a client now. I'm a user. I'm taking out my device. I'm looking at my app. And I need, the app needs to know extremely quickly, like, because we're talking about boot up, right?
Yeah, it's like the critical moment. You want ideally, 100 milliseconds and the thing is running, but now it's going to the server and is doing all these complicated evaluations.
Yeah, you're trying to figure out, okay, what, yeah. And then the server is trying to take all this data of like, okay, what's the OS? What's the device? What's the capabilities? Do they have this turned on? Do they have that turned on? Whatever the things are, and resolve a list, and taking context from the rest of your backend of like, okay, are we in some kind of special state because we're running some promotion in some other part of the business, or are we trying out some new policy? Are we doing, so you're taking like just a tremendous amount of sources and collapsing them into this flat list of like, okay, because ultimately all the platform code wants to know, all the feature code wants to know is yes or no, right? Do I enable this code block or do I enable this code block, right? And then of course the tests have individual cells, right? So it's like, okay, am I in this part of this test? And you're trying to resolve all that at boot time as quickly as possible. And so that's its own whole set of complexity that probably involves, three or four teams.
And God help you if the thing you're trying to test is like some new thing that might improve boot time.
Totally. No, absolutely. What do you do? It's like a whole other set of problems. Like, what do you do if you want to test them? Or what if you want to do, if you have an app that has signed in and signed out, what do you do if you want to test something that happens when they're signed out and you don't know who they are?
Right. And then they sign in.
And then they sign in.
They got to put in the test. But when they sign in, it's like, oh, well, this test you've put them is incompatible with this other test. You're like, well, they're in it now.
How do you test something like switching from one data framework to another?
Oh, man. Oh, no. Okay.
One networking stack to another. How do you verify that you're not crashing? How do you find out if you're crashing before your crash software would be working? How do you, because the thing about having super large code bases, or super large user bases, I should say, is that any possible thing that could happen, this will be a cross-reference to the most recent episode of Fun Fact that has been recorded at this time. The possible number of combinations is probably not a 68-digit number, but very, very, very...
arbitrarily large.
Very large. So how do you... you're going to experience... with the number of launches you have, with the number of users you have, with the number of configurations you have, you're just going to, with the number of user behavior changes, someone who uses the app slower than someone else, right? Because developers famously, our brains like go the happy path no matter how much we try.
Yes, I've seen, oh man, when I was QA, it would drive me nuts how when I would be like, hey, the developer, this happens, you can get it to crash when you do X. And they're like, oh, it works for me. And then I see them use the app
and they don't
and
do
the
X.
Most like slow,
yes,
deliberate tap,
land.
Wait for the entire thing to load. Once the entire thing loads, they deliberately tap at a very perfect, right? Whereas like as a QA, I'm not going like tap, tap, tap. I mean, anytime it's loading, I'm like randomly tapping other person on the screen just to see what happens. Yeah, exactly.
Which is software from Netflix.
Which is what the real users do, right? Is there a chaos monkeys? They'll force quit the app at any time.
At any moment.
Whenever the most inconvenient time where the app assumes it won't be force quit, they'll force quit it then.
Like one of my favorite parts of my job / least favorite parts of my job is that a bug doesn't get to me almost ever if it's reproducible.
Yeah.
I don't get these bugs. If it's reproducible, someone else has already fixed it. right? It gets to me when they're like, we don't know, but it's happening often enough that it's that it matters.
That it matters. But we're not sure how the code even gets into the state.
Yeah, we don't have any idea how this could happen. We don't know what happens. The stack trace is all apples. You know, like whatever it is. Like the stack trace doesn't even seem like it has anything to do with our code. Almost like, go figure it out. And it's like, okay, well, put my spelunking hat on. And then, you know, you get those incredible moments, those truly incredible moments where you figure it out.
Yes. Expanding.
Yeah.
Fist-pumping moments. And that's a theme that I think we'll probably continue to see, but definitely talking to leaders across all different stripes of product development, whether it's product or design or whatever, that as you get more and more into a leadership position, you sort of, by definition, if your organization is working well, you're going to be spending more and more time on those gnarlier things where you're going to have other folks on the team solving the easy things because you've done delegation well and you've set up good systems so that they have enough information to solve the easy things. And then your reward/punishment is you just kind of ladder up working on harder and harder problems throughout your career.
But by the way, even if you're in an environment where that's not true, where everyone is super senior, they're also solving really hard problems. They're just ones in domains that are not yours.
Yes, absolutely.
So maybe they're trying to figure out how to work around some crazy bug in collection view or some Swift UI thing, and they're trying to figure out, like, I need this animation to be smooth and it's just not smooth. And I wouldn't be the person to work on that. But if it's like, there's some race condition here that's causing the app to crash somehow, some of the time, we don't know.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, you know, keeps me employed. No, I enjoy it. I really do.
Thanks, Arik. It's been great having you on today.
Thank you.
Where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
Oh, man. I don't know if there's anywhere anymore. No, DanielTiger.com is my personal website where I write about...
What do you write about?
I don't know. Installing water filter systems. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's probably like the best landing spot at this point because I'm not really doing a lot of social media these days. But yeah, so DanielTiger.com.
Excellent. We'll link that up in the show notes. It Ship That Way is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. If you're a growing business and your customers need a really nice mobile app, get in touch with Steam Clock. That's it for today. You can give us feedback or rate the show by going to itship.fm, or you can check us out on Twitter and Mastodon. Send us a message, tell us what you think, and also you can rate this show on the Apple Podcasts app. That's helpful for people to be able to find the show. Until next time, keep shipping.